nor does she say anything when he's done. Holly sometimes forgets she's on the phone, so he gives her a prompt. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't. It's just weird all over. Don't you think so? Or not? Because I could be overreacting. Sometimes I do that.
Tell me about it, Hodges thinks, but this time he doesn't think she is and says so. Holly says,
You told me you didn't think Janice Ellerton would take anything from a man in a mended parka and workman's clothes.
Indeed, I did.
So that means...
Now he's the one who stays silent, letting her work it out.
It means two men were up to something. Two. One gave Janice Ellerton the zappet and the bogus questionnaire while she was shopping, and the other watched her house from across the street. And with binoculars. Expensive binoculars. I guess those two men might not have been working together, but...
He waits, smiling a little. When Holly turns her thinking processes up to 10, he can almost hear the cog spinning behind her forehead.
Bill, are you still there?
Yeah, just waiting for you to spit it out.
Well, it seems like they must have been. To me, anyway. And like, they might have had something to do with those two women being dead. There. Are you happy?
Yes, Holly, I am. I've got a doctor's appointment tomorrow at 9:30.
Your test results came back?
Yeah. I want to set up a meeting beforehand with Pete and Isabel. Does 8:30 work for you?
Of course.
We'll lay out everything. Tell them about Alderson and the game console you found in the house at 1588. See what they think. Sound okay?
Yes, but she won't think anything.
You could be wrong.
Yes, and the sky could turn green with red polka dots tomorrow. Now go make yourself something to eat.
Hodges assures her he will, and heats up a can of chicken noodle soup while watching the early news. He eats most of it, spacing out each spoonful, cheering himself on. You can do it. You can do it. While he's rinsing the bowl, the pain on the left side of his abdomen returns, along with those tentacles curling around to his lower back. It seems to plunge up and down with every heartbeat. His stomach clenches. He thinks of running to the bathroom, but it's too late. He leans over the sink instead, vomiting with his eyes closed. He keeps him that way as he fumbles for the faucet and turns it on full to rinse away the mess. He doesn't want to see what just came out of him, because he can taste the slime of blood in his mouth and throat. Oy, he thinks, I am in trouble here. I am in such trouble. 14. 8 p.m. When her doorbell rings, Ruth Scapelli is watching some stupid reality program which is just an excuse to show young men and women running around in their small clothes. Instead of going directly to the door, she slipper scuffs into the kitchen and turns on the monitor for the security cam mounted on the porch. She lives in a safe neighborhood, but it doesn't pay to take chances. One of her late mother's favorite sayings was, Scum travels. She is surprised and uneasy when she recognizes the man at her door. He's wearing a tweed overcoat, obviously expensive, and a trilby with a feather in the band. Beneath the hat, his perfectly barbered silver hair flows dramatically along his temples. In one hand is a slim briefcase. It's Dr. Felix Babineau, chief of the neurology department and head honcho at the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic. The doorbell chimes again, and she hurries to let him in, thinking, he can't know about what I did this afternoon because the door was shut and no one saw me go in. Relax. It's something else. Perhaps a union matter. But he has never discussed union matters with her before, although she's been an officer of Nurses United for the last 5 years. Dr. Babineau might not even know her if he passed her on the street unless she was wearing her nurse's uniform. That makes her remember what she's wearing now. An old house coat and even older slippers with bunny faces on them. But it's too late to do anything about that. At least her hair isn't up in rollers. He should have called, she thinks. But the thought that follows is disquieting. Maybe he wanted to catch me by surprise. Good evening, Dr. Babineau. Come in out of the cold. I'm sorry to be greeting you in my house coat, but I wasn't expecting company. He comes in and just stands there in the hall. She has to step around him to close the door.
Seen up close instead of on the monitor, she thinks that perhaps they're even in the Department of Sartorial Disarray. She's in her house coat and slippers, true, but his cheeks are speckled with gray stubble. Dr. Babineau, no one would dream of calling him Dr. Felix, may be quite the fashion plate, witness the cashmere scarf fluffed up around his throat. But tonight he needs a shave, and quite badly. Also, there are purple pouches under his eyes. Let me take your coat, she says. He puts his briefcase between his shoes, unbuttons the overcoat, and hands it to her, along with the luxey scarf. He still hasn't said a single word. The lasagna she ate for supper, quite delicious at the time, seems to be sinking and pulling the pit of her stomach down with it. Would you like... Come into the living room, he says, and walks past her as if he owns the place. Ruth Scapelli scurries after. Babineau takes the remote control from the arm of her easy chair, points it at the television, and hits mute. The young men and women continue to run around, but they do so unaccompanied by the mindless patter of the announcer. Scapelli is no longer just uneasy. Now she's afraid. For her job, yes, the position she has worked so hard to attain, but also for herself. There's a look in his eyes that is really no look at all, only a kind of vacancy. Could I get you something? A soft drink or a cup of... Listen to me, Nurse Scapelli, and very closely if you want to keep your position.
I...
Nor would it end with losing your job. Babineau puts his briefcase on the seat of her easy chair and undoes the cunning gold clasps. They make little thudding sounds as they fly up. You committed an act of assault on a mentally deficient patient today, what might be construed a sexual assault, and followed it with what the law calls criminal threatening.
I never...
She can barely hear herself. She thinks she might faint if she doesn't sit down, but his briefcase is in her favorite chair. She makes her way across the living room to the sofa, barking her shin on the coffee table en route, almost hard enough to tip it over. She feels a thin trickle of blood sliding down to her ankle, but doesn't look at it. If she does that, she will faint.
You twisted Mr. Hartsfield's nipple. Then you threatened to do the same to his testes.
He made an obscene gesture to me,
Scapelli bursts out.
Showed me his middle finger.
I will see that you never work in the nursing profession again, he says, looking into the depths of his briefcase as she half swoons onto the sofa. His initials are monogrammed on the side of the case. In gold, of course. He drives a new BMW, and that haircut probably costs $50, maybe more. He's an overbearing, domineering boss, and now he's threatening to ruin her life over one small mistake. One small error in judgment. She wouldn't mind if the floor opened up and swallowed her, but her vision is perversely clear. She seems to see every filament on the feather poking out of his hatband, every scarlet thread in his bloodshot eyes, every ugly gray speck of stubble on his cheeks and chin. His hair would be that same rat fur color, she thinks, if he didn't dye it.
I...
Tears begin to come, hot tears running down her cold cheeks.
I... Please, Dr. Babineau.
She doesn't know how he knows, and it doesn't matter. The fact is, he does.
I'll never do it again. Please. Please.
Dr. Babineau doesn't bother to answer. 15. Selma Valdez, one of four nurses who worked the 3-to-11 shift in the bucket, gives a perfunctory rap on the door of 217. Perfunctory because the resident never answers, and steps in. Brady is sitting in his chair by the window, looking out into the dark. His bedside lamp is on, showing the golden highlights in his hair. He is still wearing his button, reading, "I was shaved by Nurse Barbara." She starts to ask if he's ready for a little help in getting ready for bed. He can't unbutton his shirt or pants, but he is capable of shuffling out of them once that's accomplished. But then rethinks the idea. Dr. Babineau has added a note to Hartsfield's chart, one written in imperative red ink. Patient is not to be disturbed when in a semi-conscious state. During these periods,
His brain may actually be rebooting itself in small but appreciable increments. Come back and check at half-hour intervals. Do not ignore this directive. Selma doesn't think Hartsfield is rebooting jack shit. He's just off in Gorkland. But like all the nurses who work in the bucket, she's a bit afraid of Babineau, and knows he has a habit of showing up at any time, even in the small hours of the morning, and right now it's just gone 8 p.m. At some point since she last checked him, Hartsfield has managed to get up and take the 3 steps to his bedside table where his game gadget is kept. He doesn't have the manual dexterity needed to play any of the preloaded games, but he can turn it on. He enjoys holding it in his lap and looking at the demo screens. Sometimes he'll do it for an hour or more, bent over like a man studying for an important exam. His favorite is the fishing hole demo, and he's looking at it now. A little tune that she remembers from her childhood is playing. By the sea, by the beautiful sea. She approaches, thinks of saying, "You really like that one, don't you?" But remembers, "Do not ignore this directive," underlined, and looks down at the small 5 inches by 3 screen instead. She gets why he likes it. There's something beautiful and fascinating in the way the exotic fish appear, pause, and then zip away with a single flip of their tails. Some are red, some are blue, some are yellow. Oh, and there's a pretty pink one.
Stop looking!
Brady's voice grates like the hinges on a seldom-opened door, and while there is an appreciable space between the words, they are perfectly clear. Nothing at all like his usual mushy mumble. Selma jumps as if he goosed her instead of just speaking to her. On the Zap-It screen, there's a momentary flash of blue light that obliterates the fish, but then they're back. Selma glances down at the watch pinned upside down to her smock and sees it's now 8:20. Jesus, has she really been standing here for almost 20 minutes?
Go!
Brady is still looking down at the screen where the fish swim back and forth, back and forth. Selma drags her eyes away, but it's an effort.
Come back later.
Pause.
When I'm done.
Pause.
Looking.
Selma does as she's told, and once she's back in the hall, she feels like herself again. He spoke to her, big whoop. And if he enjoys watching the fishing hole demo the way some guys enjoy watching girls in bikinis play volleyball, again, big whoop. The real question is why they let kids have those consoles. They can't be good for their immature brains, can they? On the other hand, kids play computer games all the time, so maybe they're immune. In the meantime, she has plenty to do. Let Hartsfield sit in his chair and look at his gizmo. After all, he's not hurting anybody. 16. Felix Babineau bends stiffly forward from the waist like an android in an old sci-fi movie. He reaches into his briefcase and brings out a flat pink gadget that looks like an e-reader. The screen is gray and blank. "There's a number in here I want you to find," he says. "A 9-digit number. If you can find that number, Nurse Scapelli, today's incident will remain between us." The first thing that comes to mind is, you must be crazy. But she can't say that, not when he holds her whole life in his hands.
"How can I? I don't know anything about those electronic gadgets. I can barely work my phone."
"Nonsense. As a surgical nurse, you were in great demand because of your dexterity." "True enough, but it's been 10 years since she worked in the Kiner surgical suite, handing out scissors and retractors and sponges. She was offered a 6-week course in microsurgery. The hospital would have paid 70%, but she had no interest. Or so she claimed. In truth, she was afraid of failing the course. He's right, though. In her prime, she had been fast." Babineau pushes a button on top of the gadget. She cranes her neck to see. It lights up, and the words, "Welcome to Zap-It," appear. This is followed by a screen showing all sorts of icons. Games, she supposes.
He swipes the screen once, twice, then tells her to stand next to him. When she hesitates, he smiles. Perhaps it's meant to be pleasant and inviting, but it terrifies her instead, because there's nothing in his eyes, no human expression at all. Come, nurse, I won't bite you. Of course not. Only what if he does? Nevertheless, she steps closer so she can see the screen where exotic fish are swimming back and forth. When they flick their tails, bubbles stream up. A vaguely familiar little tune plays.
Do you see this one? It's called Fishin' Hole.
Yes. Thinking, he really is crazy. He's had some sort of mental breakdown from overwork.
If you were to tap the bottom of the screen, the game would come up and the music would change. But I don't want you to do that. The demo is all you need. Look for the pink fish. They don't come often, and they're fast, so you have to watch carefully. You can't take your eyes off the screen.
Dr. Babineau, are you all right?
It's her voice, but it seems to be coming from far away. He makes no reply, just keeps looking at the screen. Scapelli is looking too. Those fish are interesting. And the little tune, that's sort of hypnotic. There's a flash of blue light from the screen. She blinks, and then the fish are back, swimming to and fro, flicking their flippy tails and sending up burbles of bubbles.
Each time you see a pink fish, tap it, and a number will come up. 9 pink fish, 9 numbers. Then you will be done, and all this will be behind us. Do you understand?
She thinks of asking him if she's supposed to write the numbers down or just remember them, but that seems too hard, so she just says yes.
Good, he hands her the gadget. 9 fish, 9 numbers, but just the pink ones, mind.
Scapelli stares at the screen where the fish swim, red and green, green and blue, blue and yellow. They swim off the left side of the little rectangular screen, then back on at the right. They swim off the right side of the screen, then back on at the left. Left, right, left. Some high, some low. But where are the pink ones? She needs to tap the pink ones. And when she's tapped 9 of them, all of this will be behind her. From the corner of one eye, she sees Babineau refastening the clasps on his briefcase. He picks it up and leaves the room. He's going. It doesn't matter. She has to tap the pink fish, and then all of this will be behind her. A flash of blue light from the screen, and then the fish are back. They swim left to right, and right to left. The tune plays. By the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and me, oh how happy we'll be. A pink one. She taps it. The number 11 appears. 8 more to go. She taps a second pink fish as the front door quietly closes, and a third as Dr. Babineau's car starts outside. She stands in the middle of her living room, lips parted as if for a kiss, staring down at the screen. Colors shift and move on her cheeks and forehead. Her eyes are wide and unblinking. A fourth pink fish swims into view, this one moving slowly, as if inviting the tap of her finger, but she only stands there. Hello, Nurse Scapelli. She looks up to see Brady Hartsfield sitting in her easy chair. He's shimmering a bit at the edges. Ghostly, but it's him all right. He's wearing what he was wearing when she visited him in his room that afternoon. Jeans and a checked shirt. On the shirt is that button reading, I was shaved by Nurse Barbara. But the vacant gaze everyone in the bucket has grown used to is gone. He's looking at her with lively interest.
She remembers her brother looking at his aunt farm that way when they were children back in Hershey, Pennsylvania. He must be a ghost, because fish are swimming in his eyes.
You'll tell, Hartsfield says. And it won't just be his word against yours. Don't get that idea. He had a nanny cam planted in my room so he can watch me. Study me. It's got a wide-angle lens so he can see the whole room. That kind of lens is called a fisheye. He smiles to show he's made a pun. A red fish swims across his right eye, disappears, and then appears in his left one. Scapelli thinks, his brain is full of fish. I'm seeing his thoughts. The camera's hooked up to a recorder. He'll show the board of directors the footage of you torturing me. It didn't actually hurt that much. I don't feel pain the way I used to. But torture is what he'll call it. It won't end there, either. He'll put it on YouTube, and Facebook, and badmedicine.com. It will go viral. You'll be famous. The torturing nurse. And who will come to your defense? Who will stand up for you? No one. Because nobody likes you. They think you're awful. And what do you think? Do you think you're awful? Now that the idea has been brought fully to her attention, she supposes she is. Anyone who would threaten to twist the testicles of a brain-damaged man must be awful. What was she thinking? Say it. He leans forward, smiling. The fish swim. The blue light flashes. The tune plays. Say it, you worthless bitch. I'm awful. Ruth Scapelli says in her living room, which is empty except for her. She stares down at the screen of the Zapit commander. Now, say it like you mean it.
I'm awful. I'm an awful, worthless bitch.
And what is Dr. Babineau going to do?
Put it on YouTube. Put it on Facebook. Put it on badmedicine.com. Tell everyone.
You'll be arrested.
I'll be arrested.
They'll put your picture in the paper.
Of course they will.
You'll go to jail.
I'll go to jail.
Who will stand up for you?
No one.
17. Sitting in room 217 of the bucket, Brady stares down at the fishing hole demo. His face is fully awake and aware. It's the face he hides from everyone except Felix Babineau, and Dr. Babineau no longer matters. Dr. Babineau hardly exists. These days, he's mostly Dr. Z. Nurse Scapelli, Brady says, let's go into the kitchen. She resists, but not for long. 18. Hodges tries to swim below the pain and stay asleep, but it pulls him up steadily until he breaks the surface and opens his eyes. He fumbles for the bedside clock and sees it's 2 a.m. A bad time to be awake, maybe the worst time. When he suffered insomnia after his retirement, he thought of 2 a.m. as the suicide hour, and now he thinks that's probably when Mrs. Ellerton did it. 2 in the morning, the hour when it seems daylight will never come. He gets out of bed, walks slowly to the bathroom, and takes the giant, economy-sized bottle of Gelucil out of the medicine cabinet, careful not to look at himself in the mirror. He chug-a-lugs 4 big swallows, then leans over, waiting to see if his stomach will accept it or hit the ejector button, as it did with the chicken soup. It stays down, and the pain actually begins to recede. Sometimes Gelucil does that. Not always. He thinks about going back to bed, but he's afraid that dull throb will return as soon as he's horizontal. He shuffles into his office instead and turns on his computer. He knows this is the very worst time to start checking out the possible causes for his symptoms, but he can no longer resist. His desktop wallpaper comes up, another picture of Allie as a kid. He mouses down to the bottom of the screen, meaning to open Firefox, then freezes. There's something new in the dock. Between the balloon icon for text messaging and the camera icon for FaceTime, there's a blue umbrella with a red 1 sitting above it.
A message on Debbie's blue umbrella, he says. I'll be damned. A much younger Jerome Robinson downloaded the Blue Umbrella app to his computer almost 6 years ago. Brady Hartsfield, a.k.a. Mr. Mercedes, wanted to converse with the cop who had failed to catch him, and although retired, Hodges was very willing to talk, because once you got dirtbags like Mr. Mercedes talking, there weren't very many like him, and thank God for that. They were only a step or two from being caught. This was especially true of the arrogant ones, and Hartsfield had been arrogance personified. They both had their reasons for communicating on a secure, supposedly untraceable chat site with servers located someplace in deepest, darkest Eastern Europe. Hodges wanted to goad the perpetrator of the city center massacre into making a mistake that would help identify him. Mr. Mercedes wanted to goad Hodges into killing himself. He had succeeded with Olivia Trelawney, after all. What kind of life do you have? He had written in his first communication to Hodges, the one that had arrived by snail mail. What kind, now that the thrill of the hunt is behind you? And then, want to get in touch with me? Try Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella. I even got you a username. KermitFrog19. With plenty of help from Jerome Robinson and Holly Gibney, Hodges tracked Brady down and Holly clobbered him. Jerome and Holly got free city services for 10 years. Hodges got a pacemaker. There were sorrows and loss Hodges doesn't want to think about, not even now, all these years later. But you'd have to say that for the city, and especially for those who had been attending the concert at the Mingo that night, all ended well. At some point between 2010 and now, the blue umbrella icon disappeared from the dock at the bottom of his screen. If Hodges ever wondered what happened to it, he can't remember that he ever did. He probably assumed either Jerome or Holly dumped it in the trash on one of their visits to fix whatever current outrage he had perpetrated on his defenseless Macintosh. Instead, one of them must have tucked it into the app's folder, where the blue umbrella has remained just out of sight all these years. Hell, maybe he even did the dragging himself and has forgotten. Memory has a way of slipping a few gears after 65 when people round the third turn start down the home stretch. He mouses to the blue umbrella, hesitates, then clicks. His desktop screen is replaced by a young couple on a magic carpet floating over an endless sea. Silver rain is falling, but the couple is safe and dry beneath a protective blue umbrella. Ah, such memories, this brings back. He enters KermitFrog19 as both his username and his password. Isn't that how he did it before, as per Hartsfield's instructions? He can't remember for sure, but there's one way to find out. He bangs the return key. The machine thinks for a second or two, it seems longer, and then presto, he's in. He frowns at what he sees. Brady Hartsfield used MerceKill as his handle, short for Mercedes Killer. Hodges has no trouble remembering that, but this is someone else. Which shouldn't surprise him, since Holly turned Hartsfield's fucked up brain to oatmeal, but somehow it still does. Z-Boy wants to chat with you. Do you want to chat with Z-Boy? Y. N. Hodges hits Y, and a moment later a message appears. Just a single sentence, half a dozen words, but Hodges reads them over and over again, feeling not fear, but excitement. He is on to something here. He doesn't know what it is, but it feels big. Z-Boy, he's not done with you yet. Hodges stares at it, frowning. At last he sits forward in his chair and types, KermitFrog19. Who's not done with me? Who is this? There's no answer. 19. Hodges and Holly get together with Pete and Isabel at Dave's Diner, a greasy spoon a block down from the morning madhouse known as Starbucks. With the early breakfast rush over, they have their pick of tables and settle at one in the back. In the kitchen, a Badfinger song is playing on the radio and waitresses are laughing. All I've got is half an hour, Hodges says, then I have to run to the doctor's. Pete leans forward, looking concerned. Nothing serious, I hope.
Nope, I feel fine. This morning, he actually does. Like 45 again. That message on his computer, cryptic and sinister though it was, seems to have been better medicine than the gel you sell. Let's get to what we found. Holly, they'll want Exhibit A and Exhibit B. Hand them over.
Holly has brought her small tartan briefcase to the meeting. From it, and not without reluctance, she brings the Zap-It Commander and the lens cap from the garage at 1588. Both are in plastic bags, although the lens cap is still wrapped in tissues.
"What have you two been up to?" Pete asks. He's striving for humorous, but Hodges can hear a touch of accusation there as well.
"Investigating,"
Holly says, and although she isn't ordinarily one for eye contact, she shoots a brief look at Izzy James as if to say, "Get the point."
"Explain," Izzy says.
Hodges does so, while Holly sits beside him with her eyes cast down, her decaf, all she drinks, untouched. Her jaws are moving, though, and Hodges knows she's back on the Nicorette.
"Unbelievable," Izzy says when Hodges is finished.
She pokes at the bag with the Zap-It inside.
"You just took this."
"Wrapped it up in newspaper like a piece of salmon from the fish market and carried it out of the house."
Holly appears to shrink in her chair. Her hands are so tightly clasped in her lap that the knuckles are white. Hodges usually likes Isabel well enough, even though she once nearly tripped him up in an interrogation room, this during the Mr. Mercedes thing when he had been hip deep in an unauthorized investigation, but he doesn't like her much now. He can't like anyone who makes Holly shrink like that. Be reasonable, Iz. Think it through. If Holly hadn't found that thing, and purely by accident, it would still be there. You guys weren't going to search the house.
"You probably weren't going to call the housekeeper either,"
Holly says, and although she still won't look up, there's metal in her voice. Hodges is glad to hear it.
"We would have gotten to the Alderson woman in time," Izzy says,
but those misty gray eyes of hers flick up and to the left as she says it. It's a classic liar's tell, and Hodges knows when he sees it that she and Pete haven't even discussed the housekeeper yet, although they probably would have gotten around to her eventually. Pete Huntley may be a bit of a plodder, but plodders are usually thorough. You had to give them that.
"If there were any fingerprints on that gadget," Izzy says, "they're gone now. Kiss them goodbye."
Holly mutters something under her breath, making Hodges remember that when he first met her and completely underestimated her, he thought of her as Holly the Mumbler. Izzy leans forward, her gray eyes suddenly not misty at all.
"What did you say?"
"She said that's silly," Hodges says, knowing perfectly well that the word was actually stupid. "She's right. It was shoved down between the arm of Ellerton's chair and the cushion. Any fingerprints on it would be blurred, and you know it. Also, were you going to search the whole house?"
"We might have," Isabel says, sounding sulky, "depending on what we get back from forensics."
Other than in Martine Stover's bedroom and bathroom, there were no forensics. They all know this, Izzy included, and there's no need for Hodges to belabor the point. "Take it easy," Pete says to Isabel. "I invited Kermit and Holly out there, and you agreed."
"That was before I knew they were going to walk out with..."
She trails off. Hodges waits with interest to see how she will finish. Is she going to say, "with a piece of the evidence"? Evidence of what? An addiction to computer solitaire, Angry Birds, and Frogger?
"With a piece of Mrs. Ellerton's property," she finishes lamely.
"Well, you've got it now," Hodges says. "Can we move on? Perhaps discuss the man who gave it to her in the supermarket, claiming the company was eager for user input on a gadget that's no longer made?"
"And the man who was watching them,"
Holly says, still without looking up.
"The man who was watching them from across the street with binoculars."
Hodges' old partner pokes the bag with the wrapped lens cap inside. "I'll have this dusted for fingerprints, but I'm not real hopeful, Kerm. You know how people take these caps on and off." "Yeah," Hodges says, "by the rim. And it was cold in that garage, cold enough so I could see my breath. The guy was probably wearing gloves anyway."
"The guy in the supermarket was most likely working some kind of short con," Izzy says. "It's got that smell." Maybe he called a week later, trying to convince her that by taking the obsolete games gadget, she was obligated to buy a more expensive current one, and she told him to go peddle his papers. Or he might have used the info from the questionnaire to hack into her computer.
Not that computer, Holly says. It was older than dirt.
Had a good look around, didn't you? Izzy says. Did you check the medicine cabinets while you were investigating?
This is too much for Hodges. She was doing what you should have done, Isabel, and you know it. Color is rising in Izzy's cheeks.
We called you in as a courtesy, that's all, and I wish we'd never done it. You two are always trouble.
Stop it, Pete says. But Izzy is leaning forward, her eyes flicking between Hodges' face and the top of Holly's lowered head.
These two mystery men, if they existed at all, have nothing to do with what happened in that house. One was probably running a con, the other was a simple peeper.
Hodges knows he should stay friendly here, increase the peace and all that, but he just can't do it. Some pervo salivating at the thought of watching an 80-year-old woman undress or seeing a quadriplegic get a sponge bath? Yeah, that makes sense.
Read my lips, Izzy says. Mom killed daughter, then self. Even left a suicide note of sorts. Z, the end. Couldn't be any clearer.
Z boy, Hodges thinks. Whoever's under Debbie's blue umbrella this time signs himself Z boy. Holly lifts her head.
There was also a Z in the garage, carved into the wood between the doors. Bill saw it. Zappit also begins with Z, you know.
Yes, Izzy says. And Kennedy and Lincoln have the same number of letters proving they were both killed by the same man.
Hodges sneaks a peek at his watch and sees he'll have to leave soon, and that's okay. Other than upsetting Holly and pissing off Izzy, this meeting has accomplished nothing. Nor can it, because he has no intention of telling Pete and Isabel what he discovered on his own computer early this morning. That information might shift the investigation into a higher gear, but he's going to keep it on the down low until he does a little more investigation himself. He doesn't want to think that Pete would fumble it, but he might. Because being thorough is a poor substitute for being thoughtful. And Izzy? She doesn't want to open a can of worms filled with a lot of pulp novel stuff about cryptic letters and mystery men. Not when the deaths at the Ellerton house are already on the front page of today's paper, along with a complete recap of how Martine Stover came to be paralyzed. Not when Izzy's expecting to take the next step up the police department ladder just as soon as her current partner retires. Bottom line, Pete says, this is going down as a murder-suicide and we're going to move on. We have to move on, Kermit. I'm retiring. Iz will be left with a huge caseload and no new partner for a while thanks to the damn budget cuts. This stuff, he indicates the two plastic bags, is sort of interesting, but it doesn't change the clarity of what happened. Unless you think some master criminal set it up? One who drives an old car and mends his coat with masking tape? No, I don't think that. Hodges is remembering something Holly said about Brady Hartsfield yesterday. She used the word architect. I think you've got it right. Murder-suicide. Holly gives him a brief look of wounded surprise before lowering her eyes again. But will you do something for me? If I can, Pete says. I tried the game console, but the screen stayed blank. Probably a dead battery. I didn't want to open the battery compartment because that little slide panel would be a place to check for fingerprints. I'll see that it's dusted, but I doubt... Yeah, I do too. What I really want is for one of your cyber wonks to boot it up and check the various game applications. See if there's anything out of the ordinary. Okay, Pete says and shifts slightly in his seat when Izzy rolls her eyes. I just can't be sure, but he thinks Pete just kicked her ankle under the table. I have to go, Hodges says and grabs for his wallet. Missed my appointment yesterday, can't miss another one.
We'll pick up the check, Izzy says. After you brought us all this valuable evidence, it's the least we can do.
Holly mutters something else under her breath. This time Hodges can't be sure, even with his trained Holly ear, but he thinks it might have been bitch.
20.
On the sidewalk, Holly jams an unfashionable but somehow charming plaid hunting cap down to her ears and then thrusts her hands into her coat pockets. She won't look at him, only starts walking toward the office a block away. Hodges' car is parked outside Dave's, but he hurries after her. Holly!
You see how she is, walking faster, still not looking at him.
The pain in his gut is creeping back and he's losing his breath. Holly, wait! I can't keep up.
She turns to him, and he's alarmed to see her eyes are swimming with tears. There's more to it. More. But they're just going to sweep it under the rug, and they didn't even say the real reason, which is so Pete can have a nice retirement party without this hanging over his head the way you had to retire with the Mercedes killer hanging over yours, and so the papers don't make a big deal of it. And you know there's more to it. I know you do, and I know you have to get your test results. I want you to get them because I'm so worried. But those poor women, I just don't think they don't deserve to just be shoveled under. She halts at last, trembling. The tears are already freezing on her cheeks. He tilts her face to look at him, knowing she would shrink away if anyone else tried to touch her that way. Yes, even Jerome Robinson, and she loves Jerome, probably has since the day the two of them discovered the ghost program Brady left in Olivia Trelawney's computer, the one that finally pushed her over the edge and caused her to take her own overdose. Holly, we're not done with this. In fact, I think we might just be getting started. She looks him squarely in the face. Another thing she will do with no one else.
What do you mean?
Something new has come up. Something I didn't want to tell Pete and Izzy. I don't know what the hell to make of it. There's no time to tell you now, but when I get back from the doctor's, I'll tell you everything.
All right, that's fine. Go on now. And although I don't believe in God, I'll say a prayer for your test results. Because a little prayer can't hurt, can it?
No. He gives her a quick hug. Long hugs don't work with Holly, and starts back to his car. Once more thinking of that thing she said yesterday about Brady Hartsfield being an architect of suicide. A pretty turn of phrase from a woman who writes poetry in her spare time, not that Hodges has ever seen any or is likely to, but Brady would probably sneer at it, considered a mile short of the mark. Brady would consider himself a prince of suicide. Hodges climbs into the Prius Holly nagged him into buying and heads for Dr. Stamos's office. He's doing a little praying himself. Let it be an ulcer. Even the bleeding kind that needs surgery to sew it up. Just an ulcer. Please, nothing worse than that. 21. He doesn't have to spend time cooling his heels in the waiting room today. Although he's 5 minutes early and the room is as full as it was on Monday, Marley, the cheerleader receptionist, sends him in before he even has a chance to sit down. Belinda Jensen, Stamos's nurse, usually greets him at his yearly physicals with smiling good cheer, but she is not smiling this morning, and as Hodges steps on the scale, he remembers his yearly physical is a bit overdue, by 4 months. Actually, closer to 5. The armature on the old-fashioned scale balances at 165. When he retired from the cops in 09, he weighed 230 at the mandatory exit physical. Belinda takes his blood pressure, pokes something in his ear to get his current temperature, then leads him past the exam rooms and directly to Dr. Stamos's office at the end of the corridor. She knocks a knuckle on the door, and when Stamos says, "Please come in," she leaves Hodges at once, usually voluble, full of tales about her fractious children and bumptious husband, she has today spoken hardly a word. Can't be good, Hodges thinks, but maybe it's not too bad. Please God, not too bad. Another 10 years wouldn't be a lot to ask for, would it? Or, if you can't do that, how about 5? Wendell Stamos is a 50-something with a fast-receding hairline and the broad-shouldered, trim-waisted build of a pro-jock who stayed in shape after retirement. He looks at Hodges gravely and invites him to sit down. Hodges does so. How bad?
Bad, Dr. Stamos says, then hastens to add,
but not hopeless. Don't skate around it, just tell me.
It's pancreatic cancer, and I'm afraid we caught it, well, rather late in the game. Your liver is involved.
Hodges finds himself fighting a strong and dismaying urge to laugh. No, more than laugh. To just throw back his head and yodel like Heidi's fucking grandfather. He thinks it was Stamos saying bad, but not hopeless. It makes him remember an old joke. Doctor tells his patient, "There's good news and bad news. Which does the patient want first?" "Hit me with the bad news," says the patient. "Well," says the doctor, "you have an inoperable brain tumor. The patient starts to blubber and asks what the good news can possibly be after learning a thing like that. The doctor leans forward, smiling confidentially, and says, I'm fucking my receptionist and she's gorgeous.
I want you to see a gastroenterologist immediately. I'm talking today. The best one in this part of the country is Henry Yip at Kiner. He'll refer you to a good oncologist. I'm thinking that guy will want to start you on chemo and radiation. These can be difficult for the patient, debilitating, but are far less arduous than even 5 years ago.
Stop, Hodges says. The urge to laugh has thankfully passed. Stamos stops, looking at him in a brilliant shaft of January sun. Hodges thinks, barring a miracle, this is the last January I'm ever going to see. Wow. What are the chances? Don't sugarcoat it. There's something hanging fire in my life right now. Might be something big, so I need to know.
Stamos sighs. Very slim, I'm afraid. Pancreatic cancer is just so goddamn stealthy.
How long?
With treatment? Possibly a year. Even two.
And a remission is not entirely out of the question.
I need to think about this, Hodges says.
I've heard that many times after I've had the unpleasant task of giving this kind of diagnosis, and I always tell my patients what I'm now going to tell you, Bill. If you were standing on top of a burning building, and a helicopter appeared and dropped a rope ladder, would you say you needed to think about it before climbing up?
Hodges mulls that over, and the urge to laugh returns. He's able to restrain it, but not a smile. It's broad and charming. I might, he says, if the helicopter in question only had 2 gallons of gas left in the tank.
22. When Ruth Scapelli was 23, before she began to grow the hard shell that encased her in later years, she had a short and bumpy affair with a not exactly honest man who owned a bowling alley. She became pregnant and gave birth to a daughter she named Cynthia. This was in Davenport, Iowa, her hometown, where she was working toward her RN at Kaplan University. She was amazed to find herself a mother, more amazed still to realize that Cynthia's father was a slack-bellied 40-year-old with a tattoo reading, Love to Live and Live to Love on one hairy arm. If he had offered to marry her, he didn't, she would have declined with an inward shudder. Her aunt Wanda helped her raise the child. Cynthia Scapelli Robinson now lives in San Francisco, where she has a fine husband, no tattoos, and 2 children, the older of whom is an honor roll student in high school. Her household is a warm one. Cynthia works hard to keep it that way, because the atmosphere in her aunt's home, where she did most of her growing up, and where her mother began to develop that formidable shell, was always chilly, full of recriminations and scoldings that usually began, You forgot to. The emotional atmosphere was mostly above freezing but rarely went higher than 45 degrees. By the time Cynthia was in high school, she was calling her mother by her first name. Ruth Scapelli never objected to this. In fact, she found it a bit of a relief. She missed her daughter's nuptials due to work commitments but sent a wedding present. It was a clock radio. These days, Cynthia and her mother talk on the phone once or twice a month and occasionally exchange emails. Josh doing fine in school, made the soccer team, is followed by a terse reply, good for him. Cynthia has never actually missed her mother because there was never all that much to miss. This morning she rises at 7, fixes breakfast for her husband and the 2 boys, sees Hank off to work, sees the boys off to school, then rinses the dishes and gets the dishwasher going. That is followed by a trip to the laundry room where she loads the washer and gets that going. She does these morning chores without once thinking, you must not forget to, except someplace down deep she is thinking it and always will. The seeds sown in childhood put down deep roots. At 9:30 she makes herself a second cup of coffee, turns on the TV, she rarely looks at it, but it's company, and powers up her laptop to see if she has any emails other than the usual come-ons from Amazon and Urban Outfitters. This morning, there's one from her mother, sent last night at 10:44 p.m., which translates to 8:44 West Coast time.
She frowns at the subject line, which is a single word.
Sorry.
She opens it. Her heartbeat speeds up as she reads. I'm awful. I'm an awful worthless bitch. No one will stand up for me. This is what I have to do. I love you. I love you. When is the last time her mother said that to her? Cynthia, who says it to her boys at least 4 times a day, honestly can't remember. She grabs her phone off the counter where it's been charging and calls first her mother's cell, then the landline. She gets Ruth Scapelli's short, no-nonsense message on both. Leave a message, I'll call you back if that seems appropriate. Cynthia tells her mother to call her right away, but she's terribly afraid her mother may not be able to do that. Not now, perhaps not later, perhaps not at all. She paces the circumference of her sunny kitchen twice, chewing at her lips, then picks up her cell again and gets the number for Kiner Memorial Hospital. She resumes pacing as she waits to be transferred to the brain injury clinic. She's finally connected to a nurse who identifies himself as Steve Halpern. No, Halpern tells her. Nurse Scapelli hasn't come in, which is surprising. Her shift starts at 8, and in the Midwest it's now 20 to 1. Try her at home, he advises. She's probably taking a sick day, although it's unlike her not to call in. You don't know the half of it, Cynthia thinks. Unless, that is, Halpern grew up in a house where the mantra was, you forgot to. She thanks him. Can't forget that, no matter how worried she may be, and gets the number of a police department 2,000 miles away. She identifies herself and states the problem as calmly as possible. My mother lives at 298 Tannenbaum Street. Her name is Ruth Scapelli. She's the head nurse at the Kiner Hospital Brain Injury Clinic. I got an email from her this morning that makes me think that she's badly depressed. No, it might not be enough to get the cops out there. Besides, it's not what she really thinks. She takes a deep breath. That makes me think she might be considering suicide.
23. CPC 54 pulls into the driveway at 298 Tannenbaum Street. Officers Amarillis Rosario and Jason Laverty, known as Tootie and Muldoon because their car number was featured in an old cop sitcom, get out and approach the door. Rosario rings the doorbell. There's no answer, so Laverty knocks, good and hard. There's still no answer. He tries the door on the off chance, and it opens. They look at each other. This is a good neighborhood, but it's still the city, and in the city, most people lock their doors. Rosario pokes her head in. Mrs. Scapelli? This is Police Officer Rosario. Want to give us a shout? There is no shout. Her partner chimes in.
Officer Laverty, ma'am. Your daughter is worried about you. Are you okay?
Nothing. Laverty shrugs and gestures to the open door. Ladies first.
Rosario steps in, unsnapping the strap on her service weapon without even thinking about it.
Laverty follows. The living room is empty, but the TV is on, the sound muted.
Tootie, tootie, I don't like this, Rosario says. Can you smell it?
Laverty can. It's the smell of blood. They find the source in the kitchen where Ruth Scapelli lies on the floor next to an overturned chair. Her arms are splayed out as if she tried to break her fall. They can see the deep cuts she's made, long ones up the forearms almost to the elbows, short ones across the wrists. Blood is splattered on the easy clean tiles, and a great deal more is on the table where she sat to do the deed. A butcher knife from the wooden block beside the toaster lies on the Lazy Susan, placed with grotesque neatness between the salt and pepper shakers and the ceramic napkin holder. The blood is dark, coagulating. Laverty guesses she's been dead for 12 hours at least. Maybe there's nothing good on TV, he says. Rosario gives him a dark look and takes a knee close to the body, but not close enough to get blood on her uni, which just came back from the cleaners the day before.
She drew something before she lost consciousness, she says. See it there on the tile by her right hand. Drew it in her own blood. What do you make of it? Is it a two?
Laverty leans down for a close look, hands on his knees.
Hard to tell, he says. Either a two or a Z. Brady. My boy is a genius, Deborah Hartsfield used to tell her friends, to which she would add with a winning smile, it's not bragging if it's the truth. This was before she started drinking heavily, when she still had friends. Once she'd had another son, Frankie, but Frankie was no genius. Frankie was brain damaged. One evening, when he was 4 years old, he fell down the cellar stairs and died of a broken neck. That was the story Deborah and Brady told, anyway. The truth was a little different, a little more complex. Brady loved to invent things, and one day he'd invent something that would make the two of them rich, would put them on that famous street called Easy. Deborah was sure of it and told him so often. Brady believed it. He managed just B's and C's in most of his courses, but in Computer Science 1 and 2 he was a straight-A star. By the time he graduated from Northside High, the Hartsfield house was equipped with all sorts of gadgets. Some of them, like the blue boxes by which Brady stole cable TV from Midwest Vision, highly illegal. He had a workroom in the basement where Deborah rarely ventured, and it was there that he did his inventing. Little by little, doubt crept in. And resentment, doubt's fraternal twin. No matter how inspired his creations were, none were moneymakers. There were guys in California, Steve Jobs, for instance, who made incredible fortunes and changed the world just tinkering in their garages, but the things Brady came up with never quite made the grade. His design for the Rola, for instance. It was to be a computer-powered vacuum cleaner that would run by itself, turning on gimbals and starting in a new direction each time it met an obstacle. That looked like a sure winner, until Brady spotted a Roomba vacuum cleaner in a fancy-schmancy appliance store on Lacemaker Lane. Someone had beaten him to the punch. The phrase, a day late and a dollar short, occurred to him. He pushed it away, but sometimes at night when he couldn't sleep, or when he was coming down with one of his migraines, it recurred. Yet two of his inventions, and minor ones at that, made the slaughter at City Center possible. They were modified TV remotes he called Thing One and Thing Two. Thing One could change traffic signals from red to green or vice versa. Thing Two was more sophisticated. It could capture and store signals sent from automobile key fobs, allowing Brady to unlock those vehicles after their clueless owners had departed. At first, he used Thing 2 as a burglary tool, opening cars and tossing them for cash and other valuables. Then, as the idea of driving a big car into a crowd of people took vague shape in his mind, along with fantasies of assassinating the president or maybe a hot shit movie star, he used Thing 2 on Mrs. Olivia Trelawney's Mercedes, and discovered she kept a spare key in her glove compartment. That car he left alone, filing the existence of the spare key away for later use. Not long after, like a message from the dark powers that ran the universe, he read in the newspaper that a job fair was to be held at City Center on the 10th of April. Thousands were expected to show up. After he started working the cyber patrol at Discount Electronics and could buy crunchers on the cheap, Brady wired together 7 off-brand laptops in his basement workroom. He rarely used more than one of them, but he liked the way they made the room look, like something out of a science fiction movie or a Star Trek episode. He wired in a voice-activated system, too, and this was years before Apple made a voice act program named Siri a star. Once again, a day late and a dollar short, or in this case, a few billion. Being in a situation like that, who wouldn't want to kill a bunch of people? He only got 8 at City Center, not counting the wounded, some of them maimed really good, but could have gotten thousands at that rock concert. He'd have been remembered forever. But before he could push the button that would have sent ball bearings flying in a jet-propelled, ever-widening death fan, mutilating and decapitating hundreds of screaming prepubescent girls, not to mention their overweight and overindulgent mommies, someone had turned out all his lights. That part of his memory was blacked out permanently, it seemed. But he didn't have to remember. There was only one person it could have been. Kermit William Hodges. Hodges was supposed to